On the way back from Toyota factory to my hotel in Tokyo, riding on the famous Japanese Shinkansen bullet train, eating my sushi bento lunch, I'm reading the International Herald Tribune, and I come across yet another article about the killings in the Middle East. Yeah, apparently that he was a long-time correspondent for the New York Times in the Middle East, so he says, and he must have some kind of special attachment to the region. And he says, then it hit me. You know, half the world is either producing things like the Lexus, or at least trying to earn money to buy things like the Lexus. And that the other half, my friends in the Middle East, they are stuck in the past. They are fighting over who owns this little patch of barren land where there's only one olive tree. So this olive tree world people, so to speak, should wake up. All these wonderful things called globalization, and these countries should really wake up. They should join the Lexus world, so to speak. To do that, they need to open up their international trade, international investment, privatize their enterprises, deregulate the economy. It's a very, very powerful story, except that if you knew anything about Toyota's history, you wouldn't be doing this, it would be a bit like, writing a book on self-made businessman and titling it after Henry Ford Jr. Because without the government protection and intervention, Toyota wouldn't be there. If Japan decided back in 1958 to call it a day for the automobile industry and basically followed sort of Thomas Friedman kind of free trade, free market policy, the Japanese wouldn't be exporting things like the Lexus. They would still be exporting silk. And they would still fight for, who owns mulberry tree, the tree that feeds the silkworm. I can give you any number of stories, and not just any American, an American who you guys love so much that you carry his portrait all the time. It's him. On $10 bill, Alexander Hamilton, your first Treasury Secretary. Hamilton became the Treasury Secretary at the outrageously young age of 33. Back in 1789, he submitted this famous report called the Report on the Subject of Manufacturers to the US Congress in 1791. And in the report, he advances this theory of infant industry protection. It wasn't just about tariff protection, as most people think. I dare call it the first comprehensive economic development plan, because he also talked about investment in infrastructure, development of the banking sector. Banks are now creating a lot of problems here, but these are very useful institutions. Government bond market, the patent system, he was a visionary. The reasoning behind this very simple but very powerful, and in the book I explain it in the following way in a chapter titled My 6-Year-Old Son Should Get a Job. Now, my son was six, he really exists when I wrote the book, but children have this annoying habit of growing up, and he's almost nine now. But for the sake of my literary integrity, he'll have to remain six forever, and I'm sure he'll hate me for the rest of his life for that. Apparently, the son of A.A. Milne, the guy who was written up as Christopher Robin in Winnie the Pooh, hated his father until his father died. He just couldn't stand the fact that every time people loved that he was the guy in Winnie the Pooh. People refuse to see him as the real individual. Yeah? So I'm praising for that day when my son. Anyway, you know, I don't use such a strong language in the book, but I mean, in an informal setting, I would say he's a total sponger. You know, I mean, he's a or parasite, if you like. Yeah? No, I mean, seriously, I mean, I pay for everything, food, lodging, medical care, education, and do you know how expensive those Nintendo games are? So I got thinking, you know, actually, why can't he work? You know, you go to Ecuador, you go to Bangladesh, there are children who work from the age of 4 or 5. You know, it was the standard in Europe and America too, until the 19th century, that poor children started working from the age of 4 or 5. Yeah? So he is perfectly capable of making a living. Yeah? And then I think again and realize that this is a really win-win solution. Yeah? Because not only will I save a huge amount of money, this will make him a better person. Yeah? He'll be exposed to competition, he'll have to shape up. Yeah? No more wasting time in front of TV. Yeah? There you go. Yeah? Why am I not doing it? Yeah? Am I stupid? What? Yeah. No, of course I don't do it because, you know, he's reasonably competent. So I hope with another 12, 15 years of investment, he could become, I don't know, a brain surgeon or nuclear physicist or at least an economist. Yeah? Of course, there's a good chance that this guy will turn out to be a total waste of time. But even if there's only 20, maybe even 10% chance that he can become one of these things, I'm perfectly happy to invest in him because I know that the alternative of pushing him into the labor market today gives me a 100% guarantee that he will never become one of those things. I mean, it'll be 100% guaranteed that the highest he can rise maybe to own a corner job. Yeah? So it's this kind of thinking, you know, in the same way the Japanese policymakers saw it when they were trying to promote Toyota. Yeah, you know that this is a lousy company now. Yeah? But unless you make the effort to create the space for it to upgrade its capabilities, it will never grow up. Huh? Now, Hamilton proposed these things, but unfortunately, other Americans were hugely unimpressed by his proposal. You know? There's a quote in the book, but Adam Smith, the father of economics, in his famous book, The Wealth of Nations, actually explicitly told the Americans not to try to develop industry artificially. You know, your advantage lies in agriculture. Sure. No, I mean, it wasn't just him. I mean, sometime later, the famous French economist Jean-Baptiste Say apparently said, America is like Poland. Concentrate on growing wheat and pigs. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, well, this is what the World Bank says to the developing countries today. Huh? And, you know, people like Thomas Jefferson, Hamilton's political arch enemy, and the then state secretary said, and then his followers said, look, this is madness. Huh? We can sell our tobacco, sell our cotton, and use the money to buy things that are much better and cheaper from Europe. Why should we subsidize this inefficient Yankee manufacturers? And you are right. Yeah? As are people today who say, I don't know, India or Pakistan or, I don't know, Ecuador should not protect their industries. Because from a very short-term point of view, yes, definitely, well, not always, but almost definitionally, you are making a sacrifice by protecting your inefficient industries. Eh? But this is an investment in the future, in the same way that I invest in my children. Eh? So, you know, if the free market economists that really want to be consistent, not only should they not drive in Toyota, but they should stop sending their children to school. Eh? No, seriously. Okay, so was Hamilton the only guy who did that? No, I mean, Hamilton actually was very strongly inspired by someone who lived in Britain more than two generations ago, Robert Walpole, the so-called first British Prime Minister, who actually practiced a lot of policies that Hamilton wanted to implement. Only that Hamilton was clever enough to theorize it, that Walpole did it by instinct. And if you look at history of today's rich countries, you see that almost all the countries, except the Netherlands and Switzerland until the First World War, used the protectionism when they were developing countries. Particularly the United States was literally the most protected economy in the world for over a century until the Second World War. Britain was one of the most protected economies in the world until the early 19th century. Now these countries, when they reached that position of superiority, of course then realized that free trade is now in their interest. Huh? So they tell other countries to do free trade. Huh? And the title of my earlier book, Kicking Under the Ladder, comes from a passage by 19th century German economist Friedrich List, who is these days mistakenly known as the father of the infant industry argument, when the real father is actually an American called Alexander Hamilton. List said, look, Britain tells us, the Germans and the Americans, to do free trade. But actually, when you look at British economic history, they got where they are today by using protection, subsidies, and all kinds of regulations. So them telling us not to do these things is like someone climbing up with a ladder and kicking that ladder away so that the followers can catch up with him. And very sadly, this has been repeated over and over again. This country's credit, there was a period in the 1950s and 60s and maybe early 70s when the rich countries led by the US allowed the developing countries to rise together by using protection and other policies that they needed. So I'm not saying that this is human fate, but it almost looks like it. So Japan used to virtually ban foreign direct investment in the economy until the, say, 1980s.
What is this?
Today, you go to the WTO, the Japanese make submissions which says restricting foreign direct investment is bad for economic development. So how did you develop? My own compatriots, Koreans, Korea used to be the pirate capital of everything. Rockefeller LPs, Louis Vuitton bags, Nike shoes. Now, today Koreans are very upset that the Chinese and the Vietnamese are the pirate copying Korean CDs and DVDs. Come on, these people grew up listening to that pirate copied American rock and roll LPs. How can you do that? Anyway, so in the book I explain various example. If you really want to go deeper, you can, not for everything, but for some of the things, read my earlier book, Kicking Under the Ladder, but this should probably give you enough flavor of what went on. In all areas, trade policy, regulation of foreign investment, state ownership of enterprises, protection of intellectual property rights, macroeconomic policy, in all areas, what the rich countries did when they were developing are very, very different, almost the polar opposite of what they are telling the developing countries to do today. Now, when I say these things, people who are on the other side say, maybe you are right about 18th century Britain, 19th century US, but didn't the developing countries themselves monumentally screw up when they tried to use these protectionist policies? In the 1960s and 70s, a lot of these countries had the illusion that they'll use protection and try to industrialize, but they completely messed up. Now, this is one of those things that are accepted as a fact, but when you actually look at it, it's a completely different story. Because the growth rate in the developing countries slowed down massively. I mean, it basically, growth disappeared in Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa, and even in other regions, the growth rate has been basically halved since they were forced to adopt free trade, free market policies since the 1980s. So actually, it's not as if these are at least working today. It might be that, maybe today's rich countries didn't use these policies, but at least that these other free market, free trade policies are producing at least equally good or even better results, then maybe the free trade, free market theories are better, but these policies that the US Treasury, the World Bank, and the IMF have been trying to impose on the developing countries in the last 25, 30 years, not policies that the rich countries themselves used when they were developing, and B, they are not even working. Well, this is, in my view, a pretty devastating attack, but my opponents do not easily give up. So they say, isn't there a matter of equity and justice? We need a level playing field. India has average tariff of 30%. Japan and the United States have only 3. This is very unfair. Just imagine in a football game, one team is the Brazilian national team and the other is the Argentinian national team, and you let the Argentinians attack from up the hill and force the Brazilians to defend from down the hill. This is unfair. Now, level playing field is, as you Americans say, like motherhood and apple pie. It's definitionally good. You can't possibly object it. But I do. This sounds terrible. Must sound like that I'm confessing that I eat babies for breakfast. But this level playing field is a wrong principle when the players are unequal. Imagine in a football game, one team is still the Argentinian national team, but the other team is made up of my 13-year-old daughter's friends. I say it's only fair that the girls attack from up the hill and the Argentinians defend from down the hill. Now, of course, in real life, you don't see this kind of tilted playing field exactly because this kind of competition is structurally banned. Gender division, age classes, this will not be allowed to happen. And it's not just between people of different gender and age. Think about sports like boxing, wrestling, and weightlifting. They have weight classes. So even if they are both adult male, if their weights are different, they are not allowed to compete against each other. And do you know how fine these classes are in some sports? In the lighter weights of boxing, lighter weight classes of boxing, the weight class band is between 2 and 3 pounds. So in boxing, you think it's so grossly unfair that one guy who's 4 pounds heavier than the other guy boxes the lighter guy in the same ring, you structurally ban it by putting them in different weight classes. And internationally, in economics, you think, of course, Honduras should compete on equal terms with Switzerland. Yeah? That's only fair, isn't it? Yeah? You know, I mean, this kind of thinking has been kind of really preventing us from making real reforms to the global economy. Yeah? You know, of course, I mean, it sounds really fair. I mean, level playing field, no one gets a special favor, but you know, it's a bit like saying that all these disabled people get a special favor when we put up things like, I don't know, stair lifts for those who cannot walk. Well, there was a time when a lot of people thought those were special treatments, but you know, I think we are a bit more civilized than that today. So, I mean, I cannot possibly give you all the stories I have in the book. I mean, I can only ask you to read it, but I can guarantee, I mean, you may violently disagree with what I say there, but I can guarantee that it would be boring. I mean, I even have Tom Cruise for the ladies. Unfortunately, that my publisher didn't let me have his photo there, but he's right there at the beginning of chapter 7, titled Mission Impossible. Okay? Thank you.
Yes, test, test. Okay, we have a cordless mic for questions. I'm going to give it to Antonio to bring around.
Hello, who's first? Questions? Beautiful. Thank you much for coming up tonight. I guess my question is, what's been the reaction of sort of the economic intelligentsia, if you will, or the academic.
Sorry, can you?
What's been like the academic reaction to your book? Like this, everything
right.
You're talking about is very against what's.
Yeah, sure.
Has there been much of a backlash?
Yes. Well, first of all, yes. What I say here might be scandalous enough for you, but this is like, I mean, blasphemy for most economists. I mean, at least unless you are firmly on the side of free trade, you are beyond the pale as an economist. So when I write these things, I'm making probably the biggest mistakes of my professional career, but you know, if I'm going to say things that I don't believe in, I at least need to be get paid well. Yeah, so if I'm an investment banker, I can, and get paid $20 million a year. Yes, I don't mind selling toxic assets as AAA. Yeah? But I'm not doing that. And yes, I mean, this sends some of my colleagues into a fit, but I must say, I mean, I haven't seen any convincing critique. I mean, people haven't at least officially come out against this, so I'm curious to see what they say. But yes, I mean, there are predictable kind of responses like, oh, you know, the United States would have grown even faster without protectionist policy. Maybe, yeah. But don't forget that the United States was literally the fastest growing economy for about 70 years between the late 19th and early 20th century when it was the most protectionist. So how do you explain that? Yeah? I mean, they say, it might have worked in Japan or South Korea, but not elsewhere. No, hello, I mean, I just told you that it was the case with all the other countries too. So, I mean, I'm still waiting to hear the serious criticisms.
My question has to do with the fact that the United States is actually very protectionist in its agricultural policy. Isn't that the problem that the Doha Round is supposed to be addressing?
Right. Well, first of all, U.S. is not alone in protecting agriculture. But secondly, actually, that's another common misconception. People say, Doha Round is the way forward for developing countries because they need to export their agricultural products to the developed countries in order to export their way out of poverty, because agriculture is what they are good at. Well, first of all, the rich countries as a whole do not really protect the export products, agriculture products that are exported by the developing countries in the tropics, for the simple reason that they don't produce those things. So which rich country protects coffee or cocoa or banana? They don't. So the protection is mostly focused in what they call the temperate products, which are things like wheat, meat, dairy. And the main exporters of these things are actually other rich countries rather than the developing countries. And among the developing countries, even the World Bank study shows that only Brazil and Argentina are the main exporters of these things, and they are going to be the main beneficiaries. And don't forget, some of the agriculture exporters in those countries are richer than American farmers. These are huge landlords. So this is a common image of Doha Round helping the poor Ghanaian farmers export their way out of poverty is completely misleading. And on top of it, the rich countries are demanding that if you want us to cut agricultural protection, you should cut your industrial protection, which is going to make it almost impossible for these countries to industrialize, because unless you have that initial period of protection and nurturing, industries will not grow. Oh, absolutely,
Thanks very much. Your book does such a wonderful job of telling the history of some of the myths behind the sort of free trade theory. Those of us who study economics from a progressive standpoint have seen a lot of the contradictions in that theory for a long time. They're implicit in a lot of the basic theories because there are so many assumptions that don't hold true in the real world, and you lay them out over 250 years of history. I guess my question is, for 6-8 years now, some of us have been feeling that the sort of neoliberal consensus is about to collapse under the weight of its own internal contradictions and cracks. And yet, even in the midst of this ridiculous global financial crisis, the mainstream theory is still that we need to ride this out and keep pushing in the right direction and not give way to the sort of protectionist. I guess my question to you is, do you see any hope in the next couple of years for a meaningful change in the paradigm away from free trade? And now I'm taking you away from the empirical case that you make so well in your book, the sort of political analysis of where the world is going. Do you see us moving in a more balanced direction?
Thank you. No, on the first point, yes, economists make a lot of assumptions. But the conclusions are only as good as the assumptions. So if you make bad assumptions, your conclusions are going to be bad. assumptions, that's, this joke that three men were stranded in a desert island, and they see this box of canned food washing being washed onshore from the shipwreck, and they run and grab this, and they realize that they don't have a can opener. So what do you do? The first guy, who's a mathematician, begins to build a lot of intricate models of how to construct a machine to build this, and of course, I mean, there's no material, so they cannot do that. The second guy, who's an engineer, he's very pragmatic, action-oriented. He uses, coconut, pebbles, God knows what, he can get his hands on to open it, but he doesn't succeed. But the economist, he has the best solution. He says, okay, let's assume that we have a can opener. How do we divide this? That's the economist for you. Now, yes, it's really amazing how these people are refusing to accept any responsibility. It's like a doctor who does something wrong and says, it's all the patient's fault. Actually, this is very prevalent today. Especially in Africa, for example. There's a huge collapse in growth, and now in the mainstream economic journals, you have dozens of papers trying to explain why Africa didn't grow, using justifications like, they have bad weather, bad climate, which produces a lot of tropical disease, they are ethnically too diverse, they are corrupt, their people are lazy, I don't have time to go into that. So, it's never the policy, never the theory behind the policy. If it doesn't work, it must be the countries that are wrong. In the current crisis in the rich countries, you are seeing the same thing. They say, these things have happened because we didn't deregulate enough. Yes, the argument is that by having things like Fred Mac and Fannie Mae partly underwriting mortgages, by having things like deposit insurance, you have encouraged that excessive risk taking. These are clever people, they not give up. Now, times like this can make people change, but frankly, there is too much money, too much power, too much intellectual prestige at stake for things to change quickly. They try everything. I don't believe that the academic argument, books, they don't win arguments. The arguments are won on the street in national assemblies and in factories and so on. Now, of course, the intellectuals provide the ammunition, but arguments are that won or lost in the real world. So, if things go really badly, you think 8% unemployment rate in America is bad, I think it could easily go up to 11-12. But if it goes up to 17-18, you will see a serious pressure on the government to do something. And that they cannot keep people like Volcker and Summers, who are, after all, one of the creators of this problem. So let's see. We have to try. We can't just sit and hope that the economic collapse is so bad that somehow other people will put pressure on Obama to kick these people out and do something different. But we also have to acknowledge that whatever book we write, whatever campaign we run, it will be the lives of ordinary people that will decide the way the country is going to go.
My question is about new models, new ideas, new suggestions coming from the Global South, and what your view is on them. And I'm thinking particularly, for example, of the People's Trade Agreement proposed by Bolivia, but Sanders on, I think, Cuba and Venezuela as well, where they basically set out in the preamble the very paradox you talked about with the playing field. Essentially, they explicitly state in the preamble that that Bolivia is the 13-year-old's friend, that it is the least developed, thus requires the most protection, and unbalanced countries require an unbalanced trade agreement. Do you see these kind of new trade models that are emerging as viable, as a path forward, or is it just mere rhetoric?
No, I mean, basically, what these countries are doing are, of course, partly shaped by their national conditions, their history. You know, I mean, for example, Venezuela, I mean, that the pre-Chavez regimes were so corrupt. You know, that Chavez at one point said, we want to renegotiate the oil drilling rights. Yeah, the oil industry that cried out, but Chavez said, look, our previous regimes were so corrupt that they sold you these rights way, way below the going rate. Yeah, so if the going rate was, I mean, I cannot remember the exact figure, but if the going rate of royalty was, say, 15%, they sold it at like 3% or something ridiculous. Yeah? So Chavez said, I just want to bring it back to international standard. Yeah? So that shut them out. Yeah? So there are these things, but you know what they are doing are, I mean, one level, I mean, there's nothing radically new about it. Yeah? You know, I mean, people have known for, well, at least that one century that, yeah, I mean, setting up a welfare regime and more equitably distributing income is, well, not maybe always, but usually helpful even for economic growth. Yeah? People have known that without some degree of protectionism, economic development is almost impossible, and so on. So yeah, they are reinterpreting this old principles to fit their current circumstances. Now they look radically new because in the last 25, 30 years, the old principles have been buried and attacked and distorted and so on. So that you think this is completely new, but you know, I mean, Hamilton thought about the same thing 200 years ago here.
Just a question about the IMF. Just about a year ago, the IMF was only making about just over $1 billion in loans, and developing countries were spurning their advice and looking to other sources. So yesterday, the Treasury Department in the U.S. announced that we want to increase IMF support to have $500 billion in resources. But what are your thoughts on the IMF? Has the IMF changed? What are the policies they're promoting, and are they the right, and are they the only alternative, in a sense, in responding to this global crisis?
Well, the IMF, has changed a bit, you know. I mean, for example, a few months ago, Mr. Strauss-Kahn, the managing director, visited South Korea, and he was on TV interviewed by the head of the Government Economics Research Institute, and he was pressed on this point that, look, I mean, you guys, the IMF, when you came to Korea 10 years ago during the Asian financial crisis, asked us to raise interest rate, run government surplus, but how come you are now, endorsing the US government cutting interest rate and running budget deficit? And Strauss-Kahn was honest enough to say that, well, probably we made a mistake then. It's a bit too late to say that, isn't it? But the trouble is that, have they really changed? Yeah? I mean, they can say these things. I mean, they will say these things to paper over this gross double standard that the rich countries are applying in managing financial crisis. But, you know, I mean, IMF was part of the problem. Huh? So unless they say, you know, we completely screwed up and we want to take a totally different approach, and here is our commitment to doing things in these kind of different ways, I wouldn't believe them. You know, it's a bit like, I don't know, arresting a doctor for malpractice and say, well, you know, your skills don't seem to be up to standard, so we'll give you $2 million to get extra training. Yeah? You know, give me a break. I mean, unless the IMF comes up with a formal kind of recognition of the faults of their past policies and clear persuasive plan for what they are going to do differently from now on, I think giving more money to the IMF is the madness. Eh?
Okay, I want to thank everybody for coming out tonight. I want to thank the Center for Economic Policy and Research for sponsoring tonight.